1, 2, 3.
The following is a Laura Flanders Show audio exclusive.
Welcome. Glad you hit the play button to hear my full uncut with Andrea Jenkins. While you're listening, consider making a donation to support this work. You can join our Patreon partners at www.patreon.com/theLFshow. Commit a monthly donation of $3, $5, or $10 a month, or go to lauraflanders.org/donate and make a one-time donation today. Thanks. Now on to my uncut interview featuring Minneapolis City Council Vice President and Ward 8 Representative Andrea Jenkins. Andrea made history in 2017 as the first African-American openly trans woman to be elected to public office in the U.S. anywhere. In addition to representing Ward 8, which is in South Central Minneapolis, right where George Floyd was murdered, and serving as the Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council, Andrea is a writer, performance artist, poet, and transgender activist. This interview was recorded just days before an attempted clearing of the George Floyd Square, which Councilmember Jenkins supported. Here's our conversation.
You have, as I understand it, been attending multiple days of events remembering George Floyd. Can you tell us a little bit about the feeling of the 8th Ward that you represent in Minneapolis there right now?
Certainly. I have attended multiple events up until today. So on Saturday, like directly across the street from my home, which is a little less than 2 blocks away from George Floyd Square, there was an art exhibition featuring all of the collected boards that were used to protect businesses around the city during the uprisings. But at that time, this sort of explosion of art hit all the billboards, and rather than dispose of them, which many of the businesses are going to do, a number of community groups and organizers banded together to collect those boards. And it was just an amazingly beautiful exhibition. They collected over 800 boards, mm-hmm. but they displayed about 200 of them in an exhibition they called Mobilize the Movement. And so it was really just a beautiful display of how art can help to take a tragic moment and bring some joy, bring some beauty, but also bring forward the, I think, consistent messages of social justice and social change that so many people in our community have been really clamoring for and protesting for and calling for. Mm-hmm. Then the next day on Sunday, I went out to the rally that was hosted by the Floyd family and Reverend Sharpton, et cetera, with a number of community leaders. And that was a positive event. There was a rally at the government center, and then folks marched across the bridge. And, you know, I would say, Laura, there's just this real strong commitment to a continuation of pressure on local officials like myself, but even more broadly, the federal government to push forward the George Floyd Policing Act. On Tuesday, which was the 25th, which was the anniversary yesterday, I attended a number of events. There was a call for silence, a moment of silence by the mayor throughout the city, as well as concerts. And it's been kind of a festival-like atmosphere in the last couple of days.
So how do you make sense of that? And what is the feeling that you hold? I'm hearing at the same time, a reminder of the most tense moments of the last 24 or the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, a kind of celebration and coming together, but it has at its core a murder and some state violence.
Certainly. And so that has been the juxtaposition, and that has been the challenge. And certainly the celebration is not about, you know, the murder of George Floyd. I think the celebration is more about the historic moment that we witnessed and seeing law enforcement officers being held accountable for their actions. And that doesn't happen very often in the United States, and certainly not in our community here in Minneapolis. So I think there was some celebration around that. There was still trauma floating in the air, still this sense of a lack of justice. Yeah. And so it's an interesting time, and it's really difficult to explain, Laura. And I'm a poet. And like, that's my job, is to try to explain those kinds of moments. But I do think that it was helpful for people to come together. You know, in this moment of COVID, we haven't really had, throughout this whole time period of, you know, sort of the upheaval that the murder of George Floyd has wrought, we haven't really had the time to come together as a community and grieve. And so there was joy, I think, in that moment of just really being able to see people and connect as a community, but a recognition that it is somber. You know, so one of the scenes that really struck me yesterday was a group of, I guess you could call them yoga practitioners who were just meditating in the space. We also had set up, the community set up a whole expanse of cranial sacral healers and acupuncturists and meditation tents, mm-hmm. where people could just kind of go and reflect and go inside themselves and I think really began this healing process that yesterday in my mind marked the beginning of how we can start the healing process.
We're going to hear a lot, and we've heard a lot over the last year about George Floyd Square. And as you said, this is your neighborhood. This is your ward. Talk mm-hmm. to us a bit about what's been happening at 38th in Chicago. I hear, you know, the healing options, the healing offerings on the anniversary. But this is a community that's been built and that has hung in there through, you know, rough times over the last year. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you're doing with the people there? And does the city council have plans for that square?
Well, we do have plans for the square. The people that have been sort of camped out there, it's a mixture, right? It's people from around the metropolitan area, from throughout the state, but also it's really immediate neighbors who live there too. And they have been, you know, they have turned George Floyd Square into this sort of sacred space. The challenge, however, is that, you know, it has created opportunity for nefarious activities to flourish, and not to state that those issues weren't there prior to the murder of George Floyd or prior to the sort of closure of the streets, but they've been able to proliferate and grow. And there's this sense that that there is no police, and that message has been really widely sort of broadcast. And I think the police have also sort of demonstrated that they don't feel comfortable going into those spaces because they've been met with confrontation. As you know, crime has increased all throughout this country, and certainly Minneapolis has not been exception to that. And carjackings, shootings, to date, Minneapolis has lost 33 people to gun violence, which is atrocious and sad.
In this year?
In 2021, yes. And it's atrocious. It's unacceptable. And in many ways, I think the autonomous zone that has been created at 38th in Chicago, while the intentions are amazing to create this sacred space has also contributed to this sense of lawlessness. The plans that I have for the square continue to be the plans that I had even prior to George Floyd being murdered. That is, we need to create a center for racial healing, which will likely morph into a center for social justice. But we need to invest in affordable housing. We need to invest in job training opportunities for young people. All of those things, which are the demands that the community is making, are absolutely plans that I have had, that my colleagues have been supportive of, and that we can continue to move forward. One of the ideas that I am thinking about and really getting a lot of traction around is, instead of completely reconnecting the road to full-on traffic to make it a transit-only corridor that will only have bus traffic traveling through it and not other vehicles, to really lend that memorial kind of feel to the space and allow pedestrians to wander without fear of automobiles, et cetera. And I think that is the hope moving forward, and we can work with community to create that. And certainly my colleagues are supportive of that kind of, you know, maybe not that specific idea, but that kind of thinking moving forward.
This takes me to, you know, the next question for you, a city council vice president. Mm-hmm. This has been a year of a pandemic recession. We already had a housing crisis. We had an unemployment crisis. You have structural racism, sexism, homophobia, all the rest. Mm-hmm. You have many demands on you in the mm-hmm. council, but the most loud and the one that the rest of the country has heard the most about was the demand that activists brought that something be done about the police. And just 2 weeks after the murder of George Floyd, you saw the city council pledge to abolish the Minneapolis Police Department. That hasn't happened. Can you talk a little bit about what the obstacles have been and how you are navigating next steps now? But first, you know, where did you stand on that? And why has it been so hard?
Certainly. Well, I joined 8 other of my colleagues on stage to make a pledge to the community. So to be clear, it wasn't an official city council action. I mean, it wasn't like we were in a meeting and we all voted to defund the police. But I stood on stage and made that commitment to our community, demanding change. And what I personally meant is, how do we refund our communities? And so to that end, and I think this has been the conversation around the country as it concerns defunding the police, is to really reallocate funds from these bloated police budgets that we see all throughout the country and almost any community. You know, public safety encompasses 50, 60, 70% of the budget for these cities. And that comes at the expense of affordable housing, which is why we see this homeless crisis that is impacting almost every community in America. It takes away our ability to fully train our students and create the kinds of schools that we want to see in our inner cities and communities. And so we need to reallocate those funds. And that's what that specific pledge means to me. But it also has to be a wholesale reimagination of public safety and how that operates in our society. And I think public safety can no longer just be a police function. Mm. It has to include a number of the ideas that I talked about in terms of affordable housing and job training and universal basic income and creating opportunities for people to learn skills so that they can get the kinds of employment that keeps people from being desperate. And it's also really got to take a wholesale effort to rethink this whole economic equation.
Isn't it going to also require a reconsideration of your whole city charter?
Absolutely.
Can you describe that issue as it's emerged?
Yes. Well, you know, I was just going to mention, though, that, you know, people are not earning enough income.
Right.
We have this capitalistic society that is really undervaluing our communities. But to the extent of trying to change our public safety system, we have to have a charter amendment change in order to do that. And that has to be voted on by the citizens. And that question is going to be on our ballot.
Were you aware of that throughout the many years that you've been involved in Minneapolis politics? Because I think for some of the people we've spoken to, that was kind of a shock.
Well, I know that you cannot just simply change the charter.
But I mean, the idea that the police, you don't have control in the city council over the police and how big it is and who counts as police and how you do safety in your town.
I was not completely aware with all of the intimate details of the charter and how it related to the police. I was very much aware that the mayor has sole authority over the police. It's one of the only two responsibilities that are called out in the charter. And so I was very much aware of that. But I was not aware of the limited authority of the city council and or the process to make those changes. And so that was a bit of a surprise, which we learned early on in the term in 2018 when we attempted to do a very similar move. So this is not necessarily a new process. The obstacles are many. In order to change our charter, we have to A, have this referendum from the residents of the city. But even then, beyond that, if all the voters say, yeah, we want to do that, we still have to get permission from the state legislature, which is a Republican-controlled legislature. So, and you know, these are very similar types of obstacles in many other communities. And I think another big obstacle is law enforcement is not necessarily on the same page to change, and consequently, they are in opposition to that.
So let me talk about you. I mean, you made history in 2017 when you got elected as the first out African-American trans woman to hold public office, I think, in the country. And you're now on a city council that has the first out African-American trans woman and the first out African-American trans man. A lot of people outside of Minneapolis look at your council and say, this is about as progressive, diverse, interesting as you can get. If they can't do it, what are we thinking? How are we thinking change will happen? Talk to us.
Well, as you can see, Laura, at the debate in our nation's capital around the George Floyd Policing Act, these issues are very much deeply embedded in the foundation of our country. And I believe that at the root of it all is systemic racism. And so the fact that, you know, myself, I am an African-American transgender woman. I got elected, you know, and I think I got elected not because I'm transgender, but because I have extensive experience with the community and, you know, a willingness to step up and try to do the job. However, it does indicate a level of progressiveness in our community that people entrust me with the responsibility to represent them at the highest level of our city government. And I honor and respect that. And certainly my colleague who you mentioned, Councilmember Philippe Cunningham, has that same level of competence from his constituents as well. And we created a 2040 plan, which completely rezoned our entire city. Something that we also received national attention and media and acclaim for, and some vitriol too. But that is, you know, these are the kinds of progressive moves. I do believe that the conviction of Derek Chauvin was a historic watershed moment. It moves the needle. Many of the reforms that are being placed in the George Floyd Reform Act, Policing Act, we have implemented here. Our officers wear body cams. They are required to turn them on. We, 2 years ago, funded two positions. All they do every day, all day, is review body cam footage and look for issues. Not many communities are doing that around the country. So we are very progressive, but these issues are very deep, Laura, and they're challenging to overcome. But I think we can. I'm optimistic.
What kind of change, transformation, do you think is possible in the near future? What do you see on the horizon?
Well, you know, I'm really hopeful that this George Floyd Policing Act can pass. But if it doesn't, I think we can, and like New York City, begin to look at how we can end qualified immunity on our own. And what happened in New York City is the individual police officers are not responsible, but the police department is. And, you know, maybe if we put the onus on the police department to spend their budget responding to all of these atrocious acts, maybe that will help them clean up their act. Mm. So moving around qualified immunity is one of, I think, the biggest things that we can overcome. And it's one of the biggest obstacles to police accountability.
You talked about the Derek Chauvin trial, at which many people testified, many of them in tears. That testimony was triggering for lots of folks there and around the country.
Including myself.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I'm sure you have your own experience with the police. Was it triggering for you? How are you handling that?
Oh, my goodness. That was so deeply triggering, but also so inspiring to see people in the midst of the pain and the trauma that they experience come forward and provide their testimony to help convict, you know, this murderer. To see our police department, the police chief, take the stand and testify that this is not who we are. This is not how we train these officers. This is not how the Minneapolis Police Department policies are designed to operate. And I think that was a watershed moment that allows our officers to now come forward. In fact, we are requiring people to report misdeeds in the line of duty. And if they don't, then they are as culpable as the perpetrator. And so that trial was a moment that really restored my faith in humanity. I think one of the prosecutors called it a bouquet of humanity. And I was riveted. I mean, you know, like I was on the OJ trial and the trial of Michael Jackson and so many other high profile cases that we have witnessed, and including Rodney King. And I had flashbacks to that moment. You know, I lost my own brother to to the hands of the state. He was chemically dependent, like George Floyd. And in a lot of instances, when people are being arrested for suspicion of drugs, what they will do is they'll hide the drugs in their mouth. And apparently, I mean, we don't know much about this case, but my little brother swallowed the drugs as the police were trying to take them, get them out, I don't know, for evidence or whatever. And the drugs, once it was in a plastic baggie, but somehow the baggie erupted and toxic drug poisoning. He was brain damaged. We had to pull the plug after 5 days. It was horrific. And the saddest part is we couldn't get any attorneys to take a look at this case because of the drugs. And so hopefully, you know, this instance will shift some of that. I mean,
I'm so sorry for your loss, Councilwoman.
Thank you. Thank you so
you,
much.
You, it seems to me, are a real example of resilience. I'm sorry you've had to go through so much. Resilience is an overused term. You shouldn't have to be so darn resilient all the time. But you do speak to survival and endurance and maintaining, as you point out, your optimism. I'm guessing perhaps your art has something to do with that.
It does indeed. It really does. You know, my art does. I mean, but you, the struggles, the challenges that African Americans have had in this country for over 400 years is probably the biggest contributor to my resilience and my ability to continue to press on. You know, the knowledge, the recognition, the understanding that, you know, my ancestors struggled so much harder than what we are experiencing today. And in service to making it possible for me to be elected to the Minneapolis City Council as a Black transgender woman. And so, you know, I reflect on that daily, and that is what keeps me going. I'm happy to tell anybody when they ask me who my hero is, and that would be Harriet Tubman. You know, her resilience and her recognition that, you know, I can't be free by myself. Like I can only be liberated when everyone is liberated. And that kind of determination is what keeps me moving forward and what helps me to be resilient in this really challenging world that we live in.
Well, when you start the clock at Harriet Tubman and the people that brought her to where she started, it really makes a mockery of mainstream media today, looking at the clock and saying, it's been a year. Why haven't they solved police brutality and racism in Minneapolis?
Yeah, if it was easy, I heard somebody say the other day, if it was easy, Frederick Douglass would have had it figured out 250 years ago. But it ain't easy.
The struggle continues. Councilman Andrea Jenkins. Thank you so much. Really, what a pleasure. City Council Vice President Andrea Jenkins joining us. Any final comment that you want to make or anything we didn't get to that you think is important? That was really wonderful. And I appreciate you sharing the story of your brother.
Thank you so much. It's so great to meet you. But what I would say is, you know, the goals of the community members at George Floyd Square are not even remotely different from my own goals. I absolutely know, recognize, and am committed to creating a fitting memorial that will lift up the concept of social justice and honor the lives of so many people who have lost their lives to state violence, highlighting and really spotlighting George Floyd. But, you know, we're gonna talk about Jamar Clark. We're gonna talk about Philando Castile. We're gonna talk about Breonna Taylor. We're gonna talk about Ahmaud Arbery and Freddie Gray and Eric Garner and, you know, so many other people, Trayvon Martin, who have lost their lives at the hands of violence and this sort of this white supremacist notion that Black people are criminal elements that need to be eliminated.
But that involves...
I share those same goals and
but that,
we will...
But that does involve evicting the community, though, evicting the group, the George Floyd Square camp encampment that has formed. And I think what they would say with respect is you want a center. We are a center. We are creating a living alternative way of keeping one another safe. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Are we dealing with a lot of the city's problems that no one else is going to be no one else is dealing with? Absolutely. But they're fighting not to be evicted, as I understand it. And I'm not sure a center will satisfy them.
Well, I mean, we have to work to that towards those goals together. That's the only way they're going to be accomplished. And as you know, Laura, you can't operate a fully functioning city in the midst of a city autonomously. Like, how does that work? I'm not sure. What are they going to create their own taxing structure and recreate a whole nother government? Because that's what you got to do. I mean, somebody's got to be accountable. And right now, there's no accountability in George Floyd Square. In fact, I'm being held accountable and I'm being shut out. So that's not a tenable situation to continue with. The eviction doesn't have to be an eviction. We can come together and work together to build the future we want to see together.
All right. I'll take that back. An eviction that isn't an eviction.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds like you have spoken with a number of people at George Floyd Square.
Well, we haven't yet, but we're about to, and I was making a wild guess as to what they would say.
Okay. Well, you are pretty spot on of what they would say.
Yeah. I think it'll be a good, but our goal in this episode is to kind of counter some of the sort of language that I'm hearing in the papers like the New York Times about how everybody is regretting and retreating and defeated and how impossible it was. I mean, what I see is a process and people in
struggle.
And that's good.
It is a process. It's a struggle. It's no one's retreating that I'm aware of. You know, we're in this for the long haul. If it was easy, it would have been, we would not be in this moment.
Yeah, right.
This didn't happen because of neglect or we didn't care or it's very challenging work, which I am absolutely positive. The New York Times and MSNBC and CNN and Politico and The Hill and all of these people absolutely recognize, but it makes, you know, it's a good news story that's on the cover of every publication in the country. A year later, what has changed?
Right.
I mean, there are whole programs around that. A year later, Gail King did a whole program. It's a year later. Like 1 year? What? 1 year in the midst of a pandemic where all of us are sitting in our houses. The expectations are just completely unrealistic. But, and hey, if you're not helping change it, then nothing's going to change. So that's the bottom line. I appreciate the opportunity though, Laura.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Day.
And thanks for running again.